Seriously, and the test of it is, what can you be kicked out for? You can, you know, you can embezzle funds, you can be a drunk, you could be anything. But the moment you make a sexual mistake, out you go. That's what scammers. So, what do you mean by being immoral? What has come to your mind when you say somebody's immoral? Does it mean that he cheats and forges checks? It sure doesn't. What do you mean by living in sin? Does that mean that you're conducting a butchery? No, it means sex. I remember when we were in school, we had every year a certain clergyman came to visit us. And he had beetling eyebrows and was a very fierce kind of personality. And he always talked on the subject of drink, gambling, and immorality. And he rolled it round his tongue just like that. So immorality. You know, it meant sex. And but you see the duplicity of this. By making sex the naughtiest thing imaginable, it's made it terribly interesting. So this poses to anybody who becomes aware of this, this poses to everybody who's gone through psychoanalysis or anything like that, the question that St. Paul raises in the Epistle to the Romans. St. Paul explains that were it not for the law, he would never have known what sin was. Except the law had said, thou shalt not covet, I had not known lust. And so he says, it is only, therefore, because we came to know of sin, that there can be deliverance from sin. The fact that we discovered that we were really incapable of being virtuous is the one really important thing for being in the process of being saved. Now, in that case, then you will notice that human history has done a very strange thing. Until 100 years ago, the course of human life remained at a certain even level, which it had maintained for thousands of years. Life in England or France in 1700 was not remarkably different from life in Rome, B.C. 50. Or in Alexandria at the same period, where they had evolved extremely high cultures. And so far as peasant life is concerned, outside the great cities, it had remained substantially the same for thousands and thousands of years. But suddenly, with the Industrial Revolution, the whole human race goes like this. The population suddenly starts expanding at an unprecedented pace. And power is blowing out of us in all directions. Something quite different has happened. And the speed of social change, in other words, the rhythms of everyday life, are completely changed. Now, bees and ants have kept their life rhythms going for probably millions of years without any change at all. They are very successful societies. And they are what you might call non-historical societies. They have no history. Because they have a completely settled life. And in the same way, when human beings have a completely settled agrarian life, they do not record their histories. There is nothing to record. It's the same day after day. Are we, as someone has suggested, I forget his name, called it, he wrote a book called Post-Historical Man, are we about to enter a non-historical stage? Spengler thought that we were going to turn into what he calls a fellaheen culture, we're an enormous milling mob of fundamentally people who are just getting by. And eventually we are taken over by various beneficent despotisms which run us like an anthill, and that this may go on for hundreds and hundreds of years. Or what is far more likely, are we going faster and faster and faster towards the point of blow-up, in which we turn into a star? Well, now, it is said in the Hindu cosmology myth that as the Kali Yuga progresses, it becomes easier and easier for anyone to be liberated. Right at the beginning of the manifestation, liberation was amazingly difficult. And the reason was that life was too good. It was so pleasurable and delightful that nobody wanted to leave it. Obviously not. Because if the game, if the fundamental game is one of hide and seek, and therefore the initial phase of the game is to get lost, then in that case nobody wants to wake up, because the Godhead doesn't want to wake up, not yet. But then, as you see, you get bored with being merely happy, and you start getting adventurous. You get involved in more and more far-out situations in which you goose yourself, you thrill yourself with the idea of being out of control. Let go, let go. So therefore, by studying our own energy patterns, we begin to understand what's going on in general. So in the same way, you might say that in the game of hide and seek, the hiding, the abandonment of control, gets more and more far out. But it goes along simultaneously with an attempt to control things more and more. Now, you remember how I described the two-way nature of a tree pattern, from the roots to the twigs, but also from the twigs to the roots. Well then, it is said by very deep Hindu metaphysicians that the pralaya and the manvantara, the manifestation and the interval between manifestations, are really simultaneous. You, if you're truly enlightened, you see that time itself is an illusion. There is in fundamental reality no succession. There is only the appearance of succession, as when you observe a Rorschach blot under the influence of LSD. It looks as if the blot is flowing into position. It is moving. You can see the paint or the ink or whatever is on it going, but it's always standing still and it's moving at the same time. So that's the situation we have. Eternity and time together. It's always there, but it looks as if it were changing. But it keeps changing into the same thing, hence the French proverb, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. The more it changes, the more it's the same thing. It keeps turning into itself. So the counter-movement is this, that at the end of the cycle, things get more and more out of control, and everybody, every individual, has the sense of powerlessness, that the government is out of hand, that nobody is put up for election whom we care to vote for, that the whole thing is a mess, and that you can't do anything about it, and the wars, which we don't want, get more and more imminent and dangerous. Yet at the same time, we are trying to control everything, And so government gets more and more uptight. And at the same time, since we are coming to the end of the cycle, in which the divinity wakes up from the dream, more and more people are beginning to have mystical experience. That is the waking up process. But then, in all this, there is the kind of terror, you see, of waking up. Because that is a way of experiencing one's own hush to oneself. That is to say, when you want to play hide and get lost and imagine that you are all this, and that is your firm intention, so much so that it produces the vivid reality of all this going on, you are repressing who you really are, what you really are. And that repression, when uncovered, is experienced in the form of terror at finding out. Don't look into the secret box. See? There's always something. There's always a forbidden area. There's always something behind the scenes with a sign that says, "Keep out." You mustn't find out what goes on in there. And so, naturally, the suspicion in which the mystics have always been held is that they disobeyed the keep out sign. They looked under the carpet. They peeked through the bathroom keyhole. They found out what was going on behind the scenes. The mystic is a peeping Tom. Yes, obviously, from the point of view of the management, because the management keeps the show going. The show must go on. You must be responsible. The mail must be delivered. People must be fed. Babies must be looked after. Of course, the show must go on. And therefore, any suggestion that this is completely unnecessary will be regarded as utterly subversive. And of course, it is subversive. Because it turns the carpet upside down, that's all. So then, you get this really frightening picture that as we move ineluctably towards the final colossal explosion, we all begin waking up, and we begin to see in our visionary experience the great white light. Well, what do you suppose that is? Why, that's the star you're going to turn into. The light of glory. God in the form of the sun. Greatest and most ancient symbol, even used by Christians, when God is called the sun, S-U-N, of justice, and is born and in the form of Christ at the winter solstice, which is the period of the birth of the sun, because it is when the sun is at the lowest point in the midheaven and is starting to rise again towards the summer solstice. Now, just let's suppose, I mean, I've been telling you a fairy tale, a science fiction sort of thing. Let's say we're getting into a new thing called metaphysical fiction. And let us see if that is the possibility, and what is actually happening, what will be our attitude towards it practically? We can react in horror and say, "Oh no, not that." Of course, it happens in nature all the time. Tribes of insects or animals of various kinds, lemmings, methodically annihilate themselves. They commit group suicide. So we can object to it very strongly. But the curious thing is that the harder we object to it, the faster it happens. All warmongers are pacifists. And therefore they call their war department the Department of Defense. They're always fighting for peace. And for justice or some good cause. So it is highly possible then that if we accept that this is the state of affairs and we do not do anything to try to prevent ourselves from blowing ourselves up, that this could very possibly have a slowing down effect on the whole process. What happens, you see, is that the system does blow itself up through expansion of its control over itself. So therefore, the more you have the powerful fascistic type government, whether it masquerade under the name of communism or capitalism or whatever, it's all the same thing. The government is invariably the most successful group of gangsters. So when it gets very, very tough and strong, you can see then that the world is getting uptight. And as any system whatsoever gets uptight, it begins to vibrate too fast. It's the same principle as the thermostat. If you get the thermostat uptight, that simply means that you have put your on switch point and your off switch point too close to each other. When you wanted to control the temperature of the room and keep it exactly at 70 degrees, so that you put the off switch at 71, the off switch at 69 and the on switch at 71. No, sorry, the other way around. It goes off at 71 and on at 69. Then you see what happens is it's too close. The mechanism confuses the go with the stop signals. And so it starts going on and off, on and off, on and off, and it shakes itself to pieces. That is a mechanical analogy of anxiety. And to be uptight, you see, is to be anxious. And so the colossal paranoia and anxiety that spreads through the world today on all sides, engendering vast secret services, espionage systems, espionages on espionages, and police looking after policemen, and all that kind of thing, is what is going to blow it all up. Because it's all being done in the name of security. You know, the security officer. There is no security. There never was. And everything that is done to ensure it is a source of trouble. Like insurance. Read Ambrose Bierce, The Devil's Dictionary, the section on insurance. So then, the only thing that might be done is really to do nothing. To start relaxing. Saying, well, if rape is inevitable, enjoy it. By doing this, we would considerably slow down our own demise. In other words, one says to the people who want power, you want power? Take it. You bore yourself. You tie yourself up in knots trying to arrange everything. And I think that under such circumstances we would find there would be a considerable solution of problems. You know, it's like the riots. If the police weren't there, they wouldn't have happened. It was by anxiety to keep everything under control that you started a riot. Now, I'm not saying that I know the details of how to work this out, but I am saying that if that is the direction in which things go, you cannot oppose it. There's no point in opposing it. You could, by understanding that you have to go with it, you could tack against it and slow it up. But we do know that life is always a process which tends towards death. It tends to run down. Things fall apart. They wear out. Even though the biological organism is different from the geological. The geological simply disintegrates slowly. The biological tends to work against entropy. But it still always comes apart in the end. And therefore, we have to see that maybe one lives by accepting death just as one flies by an understanding of gravity. Using judo, there may be a way of using judo against gravity to throw ourselves up into the air. How do you suppose a salmon jumps upstream? It isn't just a matter of muscle. It's quite certainly, I think, a question also of the angle of the tail to the falling water. It's like a dolphin can set its tail at a certain angle to the wave made by the bow of a ship and can skitter along the water riding on that wave. It's a big surf job. So then, if for any reason whatsoever or in any design whatsoever, life is a system that is always deteriorating. Sure, it may be going up like this, you see, but it always drops. And after it's gone like this and this and this and this for a certain cycle, it's going to go like this and this. Probably getting a bell curve or something in the end. So, the moral of all this is really that the current fear, paranoia, mistrust of everyone and everything is itself the process of destruction. If you can get it into your heads that, well, it just doesn't matter. Survival is not the important thing, because you're not going to survive. This will do two things. One, it will eliminate an enormous amount of hostility and, as it were, trigger-happy fingerness . Two, it will liberate an enormous amount of our energy from defensive, security, military projects to things that are more economically useful, like the provision of food. You cannot, you see, be even a good soldier until you have reached a certain stage of development where it makes no difference whether you live or die. This was always part of the training of the samurai, that before he could really learn the use of the sword under a skillful master, he had to get to the point where he wasn't constantly anxious to defend himself. Because that put his body into a certain kind of tension, which rendered him incompetent. He had totally to overcome the fear of death. That was the first requisite. And you can overcome the fear of death only by realizing that it's completely inevitable. That everybody here is as good as dead, under sentence of death. Only because you don't know when it's going to happen. It isn't such a grim affair as somebody in death row, although it's just as certain, and just as they hire lawyers to put it off, you carry on business and generally delay your demise. The thing that makes the death row peculiarly awful is that it's also deliberate. And nothing is more torturing to a human being than to be a complete social outcast. We're despised by everybody else. He has a real reason to feel paranoid. But otherwise, we are all just as much under sentence of death. And there simply is no point in straining to prevent this happening. That doesn't mean that you cease to take care in driving a car or to be sure that you don't eat poison and so forth. But it means get off the strain, the general uptightness about preventing one's own demise, and you'll live long. It doesn't seem logical, but I think I've demonstrated that it is. For you see, it is through the acceptance of death that you become suddenly charged with life. But I say, if you give up the impossible task, you have all the energy that you've been using to strain against the inevitable, to do something great, so that you become alive in the degree that you accept death. This is true of the individual, and it can be equally true of society. That as society realizes that, we cannot hold the form of our nation, the form of our civilization, the form of our culture, we cannot stop that disintegrating, then the culture starts to swing. So it seems to me that the only time to begin that is now.